Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
All right, so we are in Leviticus chapter 25 today. Bihar, it's normally this section is, in non-leap years, is combined with the rest of the book of Leviticus. So we do 25, 26, 27. Because it's a leap year, this is just broken up independently. So we're covering Leviticus 25 through the first two verses of chapter 26. The Shemitah cycle years. Fun topics. Hopefully it will be interesting for us. So Leviticus 25. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say unto them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall observe a Sabbath rest for the Lord. For 6 years you may sow your field, and for 6 years you may prune your vineyard, and you may gather in its crop. But in the seventh year shall be a complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. Your field you shall not sow, and your vineyard you shall not prune. The aftergrowth of your harvest you shall not reap, and the grapes that you set aside for yourselves you shall not pick. It shall be a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath produce of the land shall be yours to eat, for you, for your slave, for your maidservant, and for your laborer, and for your resident who dwells with you. And for your animal and the beast that is in your land shall all its crop be to eat, be for eating. You shall count for yourselves 7 cycles of sabbatical years. 7 years, 7 times. The years of the 7 cycles of sabbatical years shall be for you 49 years. You shall sound a broken blast on the shofar in the 7th month on the 10th day of the month. On the day of atonement, you shall sound the shofar throughout the land. You shall sanctify the 50th year and proclaim freedom throughout the land for all its inhabitants. It shall be the Jubilee year for you. You shall return each man to his ancestral heritage, and you shall return each man to his family. It shall be a jubilee year for you. This 50th year, you shall not sow, you shall not harvest its aftergrowth, you shall not pick what was set aside of it for yourself. For it is jubilee year, it shall be holy to you. From the field you may eat of its crop. In this jubilee year you shall return each man to his ancestral heritage. When you make a sale to your fellow or make a purchase from the hand of your fellow, do not aggrieve or aggravate one another. According to the number of years, the jubilee year, shall you buy from your fellow. According to the number of crop years, shall he sell to you. According to the greater number of years, shall you increase its price. And according to the lesser number of years, shall you decrease its price, for he is selling you the number of crops. Each of you shall not aggravate his fellow. You shall fear the Lord your God, for I am the Lord your God. You shall perform my decrees and observe my ordinances and perform them. Then you shall dwell securely in the land. The land will give its fruit, and you will eat your fill. You will dwell securely upon it. If you will say, "What will we eat in the 7th year? Behold, we will not sow our crops and not gather our crops, not sow our fields to gather our crops. I will ordain my blessing for you in the 6th year. It will be yield a crop sufficient for the 3-year period. You will sow in the 8th year, but you will eat from the old crop until the 9th year. Until the arrival of its crop, you will eat the old. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity." Forever. Perpetual. "For the land is mine. For you are sojourners and residents with me. In the entire land of your ancestral heritage, you shall provide redemption for the land. If your brother becomes impoverished and sells part of his ancestral heritage, his redeemer who is closest to him shall come and redeem from his brother's sale. But man will have no redeemer, but his means suffice, and he acquires enough for its redemption. Then he shall reckon the years of its sale and return the remainder to the man to whom he had sold it. And he shall return to his ancestral heritage. But if it does not acquire sufficient means to repay him, then his sale shall remain in possession of its purchaser until the Jubilee year. In the Jubilee year, it shall leave and return to his ancestral heritage. If a man shall sell a resident house in a walled city, its redemption can take place until the end of the year of its sale. Its period of redemption shall be 1 year. But if it is not redeemed until its full year is elapsed, then the home that is in a city that is a wall shall pass in perpetuity to the one who purchased it. For its generations, it shall not go out in the Jubilee year. But homes in the open towns, which have no surrounding wall, shall be considered like the land's open field. It shall have redemption and shall go out in the year of Jubilee. As for the cities of Levites, the homes in their cities of their ancestral heritage, Levites shall have an eternal right of redemption. And what one will buy from the Levite, a home that is unsold, or the city of its ancestral heritage, shall go out in the Jubilee year. For the homes of Levite cities, that is their ancestral heritage among the children of Israel. But the fields, the open land of the cities may not be sold, for it is an eternal heritage for them. If your brother becomes impoverished and his means falter in your proximity, you shall strengthen him, proselyte or resident, so that he can live with you. Do not take from him interest and increase. You shall fear your God and let your brother live with you. Do not give him your money for interest, and do not give him your food for increase. I am the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt, to give the land of Canaan to be God unto you. If your brother becomes impoverished with you and is sold to you, you shall not work him with slave labor. Like a laborer or a resident shall he be with you. Until the Jubilee year shall he work with you. Then he shall leave you, he and his children with him. He shall return to his family, and to his ancestral heritage shall he return. For they are my servants, whom I have taken out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold in the manner of a slave. You shall not subjugate him through hard labor. You shall fear your God. Your slave or your maidservant, whom you may own, from the Gentiles who surround you, from among them you may purchase a slave or a maidservant. Also from among the children of the residents who live with you. From them you may purchase, from their family that is with you, whom they begot in your land, and they shall remain yours as an ancestral heritage. You shall hold them as a heritage for your children after you to inherit as a possession. You shall work with them forever. But with your brethren, the children of Israel, and man with his brother, you shall not subjugate him through hard labor. If the means of a sojourner who resides with you should become sufficient, and your brother becomes impoverished with him, and he is sold to an alien who resides with you, or to an idol of a sojourner's family, after he has been sold, he shall have a redemption. One of his brothers shall redeem him, or his uncle or his cousin shall redeem him, or a relative of his family shall redeem him, or if his own means become sufficient, he shall be redeemed. He shall make a reckoning with his purchaser from the year he was sold to him until the Jubilee year. The money of his purchase shall be divided among the number of years. He shall be regarded with him like the years of a laborer. If there are yet many years, he shall repay his redemption accordingly from the money of his purchase. And if there are few years left the Jubilee year, he shall reckon that with him, according to his years that he shall repay his redemption. He shall be with him a laborer hired by the year. He shall not subjugate him through hard labor in your sight. If he has not been redeemed by these means, then he shall go out the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. The children of Israel are servants to me. They are my servants, whom I have taken out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Chapter 26. You shall not make idols for yourself. You shall not erect for yourselves a statue or a pillar. And in your land you shall not place a flooring stone upon which to prostrate oneself. For I am the Lord your God. My Sabbath you shall observe, and my sanctuary you shall revere. I am the Lord. Leviticus chapter 25 and the first couple of verses of chapter 26. Before I have any of my notes and topics about this issue, any comments, questions, ideas? Yes, Deanna.
I think it just might be the way my Bible says it, but are they paying for all the times they had the land? when they're making a sale.
They count. How many years are our Jubilee left?
And do they count how much the land is worth?
Yes. Or,
and then they have to pay them according
to that.
Pay
that price. Exactly.
Okay. That's what I was concerned about.
Yeah. They measure. So it's a 50-year cycle. They count out how many years there are of usable years minus all the Shemitah years because you can't make money off those. And they do all the calculations to figure out, okay, well, how many good years left are this number? And then that's what the pay is accordingly. Yes, Anne.
Well, the way we are here, we move so much. I don't know how we would do this
forever. We do forever immediately. Yes.
It looks like is that just for Israel or the land of Israel, or is it could it be? I mean, I know the kingdom is the kingdom, so
right,
I don't know.
Right. That's a debatable topic. Whereas what it does apply to. The reason it's debatable is because obviously it's for the land of Israel. However, any land that is dedicated to God at a public or government base or government dedicates it, that land is classified as owning or God owns it. Not to say that applies to an individual who dedicates land. It has nothing to do with it. It's when a government dedicates land to God, then therefore it is God's land, not people's land. So any government that does so, this would apply. I'm not referring to a pagan god. I'm referring to our God. Dedicate land to our God. Our country has been done, yes. Our country was dedicated to God. Israel was dedicated to God. I don't know if there's a third one out there or not. Yes. It was. Very, very many, multiple times. Washington dedicated it. Jefferson dedicated it. I think I forgot the other guy, too, who dedicated all three presidents dedicated it each time. They did the entire country as foundation. Also, the men who wrote our Declaration of Independence dedicated it. All of them did it the exact same time, same prayer, same. The whole country was dedicated. So anything we own, meaning anything our government then acquires afterward, is still classified as God's land. It's all. So all the territories, which is like Puerto Rico and Guam, and there's a third one somewhere. Isn't there a third one? So, yeah. Alaska's a real state, but. But anyway, all those belong to God's ownership. Well, honestly, not to be cold-hearted about it, but truly, does a deed really mean anything? If you stop paying your taxes, do you still get to own the land? No. Really, deeds don't. They're just a piece of paper from... It's an illusion, right? Because the government actually always owns your land. Try not paying your property tax and see what happens. I mean, just be honest. They don't say, oh, please, please pay it. They just take it. So reality is our land is always, I think every land on earth, is always owned by the government. The people are nothing more than just livers, occupiers, renters. And we exchange huge amounts of money for it, but we're really just renters. The government owns land. Well, yeah, those are details. Anyhow, so any questions regarding so far? All right. Oh, yes.
The house that was surrounded, that was in a city.
Correct.
So nobody can own land in a city?
A walled city is a house. A house is a walled city. So, for example, well, modern-day equivalent of a walled city is a political city boundary, as opposed to we don't physically build walls around cities anymore. We have, there are city limits, there are outside city limits. So city limits, typically there aren't farms, there are rare occasions, inside city limits. Usually farms are outside city limits because that's a farm. It's really big. It takes a lot of space. And so what they were referring to, residences inside of a city, they're referring to houses which are usually bought and sold inside cities. There aren't usually many farms. Okay, granted, Wally's is an exception. It's a farm inside of the middle of Santa Rosa. There are a few, but they're not many. They're not common. It didn't start inside a city. The city acquired it later. It was actually its own town. It was its own little... And Wally Gardens was the town, I think, many, many, many years ago. Any questions regarding that topic? Okay. Okay, so this chapter 25 starts out, of course, talking about the Shemitah year cycle, which, of course, is a seven-year cycle of counting. Of all the holy days, of all the various days we celebrate throughout the feasts of the years, the Shemitah cycle, or the seven-year sabbatical cycle, if you will, is the only one that is Shabbat only one, is the one that's dominantly applicable to Shabbat. We can see the obvious parallels. It actually explains you have your 7 days a week. You got 7 years. It's a cycle that's designed for the seventh day is rest, the seventh year is rest. It's clearly designed to direct your attention to Shabbat. So that's really what it is. It's designed for a Shabbat rest, a day of rest, or in this case, a year of rest. In this analogy, if you can see it, if you will, the command for man was we work through the first 6 days, and man rests on the seventh day. That was our instructions. Our animals, our maidservants, all the things that work for us rest on that day. So, in this case, for the Shemitah cycle, the land is what's resting on that day. Well, if you do the obvious parallel, man is made from dirt, right? So, what's the point? Man rests, land rests. It's the symbol of the land is you. You are the land. They're one and the same. So when we abuse a seven-year cycle, we are abusing ourselves. That is the symbolism behind it. You are making yourself work when you violate the seven-year cycle. You're as if someone's violating you, as if you were a slave. And so, okay, slave, it's Shabbat. Tough luck. Go to work anyway because you're a slave. Well, you're making the land a slave to you when you make it work on the seventh cycle. It's the same process, the same symbolism. So that's the whole point or the symbols behind the cycle counting and why it is so similar to Shabbat in its nature and how it's designed and explained here. This is not the only place that these cycles are talked about. They're also put in Deuteronomy, which we'll get to in a little while. And it gives a little bit more detail as far as what happens and other information we can glean from this resting cycle. I want to bring to your attention, this is not a normal man-created invention. We are not in the business of sleeping. I am. I love that we're sleeping. Resting is not our way of life. Work, prosperity, wealth, money gathering, that's what we do. It really is. And most of us don't work for the fun of it. We work because we get paid. But that's really, I mean, honestly, we get work because we get paid. And we use the money to go do stuff with it. Buy food, pay clothing, go on vacations. You can afford them. Whatever you want to go do, that's the whole point of how you work. You work in order to live. You don't live so that you can work. It's the other way around, right? So we're working to in order to live. And it is our nature to always say, hey, here's a whole day which I can gain more. I can get further ahead. A little bit extra money. It's our nature to do that. So, well, I'd be better than my neighbor. I'll just work a little more. And then I have more money than my neighbor does, or the Joneses, we should argue it, and get ahead. God's intention was for us to purposefully not do that. So he gave us a seventh day Shabbat. He gave the land a seventh day rest, or seventh year rest. Contrary to modern farming methods, those of you, now I am not a farmer by any stretch of the imagination. I probably will never be. Who knows? Farmers don't do this. They do something totally different. Not crazy, but just totally different. Do crop rotation is one of the cycles. So, for example, let's say year one, you grew crop Y. Year two, the same field grows crop Z. Year three will grow crop Y or X, whatever it may be. That's our cycle of most crops, most farm cycles, modern day commercial farms, not individual gardens, but like little organic farmers, boutiques type style. They go, and then they reset the cycle. So then they go Y again, then they go Z, and then they go X, then they go Y again, Z, X, nonstop, perpetually. It continues to cycle the process through. And the idea is that, well, each one crop sucks up a huge amount of stuff out of the ground, it depletes the ground of whatever nutrients, minerals, blah, blah, there are. The next crop will suck up totally different ones and put different ones back in the ground, vice versa, go back and forth. For example, how we have so many soybeans and corn crops in our country, because those are two complementary crops. Do they rest the land? No, they usually don't. They fertilize like crazy, but they don't rest it. Now, in the other small boutique styles of farming, which is, I consider boutique, you know, like 10 acres or less kind of thing, small farms, typically you'll see they grow crop Y, whatever it may be, in one section of the field. Leave the other section fallow, untouched. Leave it alone. So half the land is used. I'll do it Y over 2. Half the land is used in one section. And then the next year, they cycle. The what have you on section 1 is now moved over to section 2. And section 1 is either left fallow or grow something else. But they cycle through a fallow field. A field that's left alone. And they go through, they may grow half dozen crops, or who knows maybe, or you may do so in your own gardens. One year I planted tomatoes on this side of the garden, next year tomatoes are on that side, and I swap it around, I move things around so no one plant is isolated. It happens real common. The boutique style is a large version of your local garden. So they may have, you know, they have an X over 2, or and then they have a fowl that floats around periodically. So every so often, you have a fowl section of land that's just left alone. That is also not God's plan. Well, that works really, really well, right? It does. But it's not God's plan. That was not his intent. You know what? I will explain why God dictated certain things, but he did dictate certain instructions came to cropping and selling stuff and growing things. One of them was mixing of seeds, mixing different crops together and intermingling. I do not know how many of you have grown squash. How many kinds of variety of squash can you grow in the same spot? A lot. And what happens to them? They cross. So I had the strange experience of seeing some squash that was crossed in our garden that I had. They were volunteers. They came up the year before, right? I couldn't eat them. They were tasted awful. Well, the bugs ate half of them, and we tasted one. It didn't taste very good. So it crossed. I forgot all the different varieties. I think it was at least 2. There was Delicata mixed with something else. It was a big round. It was striped like Delicata, but it was round. It was funny looking. Anyway, squash pollinate from one. Pollinates the other one, it gets to a flower, the other one, and they grow a new thing, a new hybrid, a new squash. Pull the seeds out of that, and it makes something, whatever, something different. Who knows what's going to grow next time around? We'll talk about that a little bit. So if you cross seeds, you don't get what you planted. You get a mix. And squash, among a few other plants, squash is not the only one, a few do this as well. And you cross enough of them to become poisonous. If you recall, there's actually a section of the Bible. It's about Elisha, and some men went out, they grabbed some gourds, wild gourds, they put them in a pot. They said, oh, there's poison in the pot, there's death in the pot. They were gathering squash, but it was a whole bunch of whatever over the wilds of crossbred. And so the squash in this case wasn't good to eat. Now, it doesn't have to be. You can create, I don't know how many varieties of squash there are. Probably hundreds, if not thousands of varieties. But the point is that was one example. If it continuously crosses, it's not what it was originally. It's something different. Maybe what you wanted, maybe not what you wanted, but it's just something different. Anyway, so in God's cycle, he intends for you to plant a particular crop. Not necessarily the same crop every year, but a particular crop. That's what you crop X is what you planted. You might continue planting crop X for 6 years. Or you might change it up. I'll plant crop X for 1 year, and then I'll plant crop Y for the next. Or maybe I'll alternate. Who knows? That's your business. You can still alternate it, but the point is, on the 7th year, leave it alone. Don't touch it. That happens every 7 years, all the way through the cycles. Every 7 years. Now, I have circled up here, I didn't write them all down. We also have a 49 and a 50th year cycle, which, of course, shows up at the year of Jubilee. I have to draw a little diagram up here real quick. This is fine. Well, this is how I see years as circles. You may not, but this is what I do. So, here's my year. I represent it as a circle. So I'm walking along a path going around. It's like taking laps. So I usually mark here, a little dot here. This is Aviv. Aviv, springtime, first day of the year. First month, the first day of the year. Starts here on my drawing. So it goes through here. This is where your years start and end. Starts and ends that on Aviv. Well, the day before is the end of the year. The day of Aviv is the first of the year. It starts and ends at that time site, the time slot. In this instance, as it explains, excuse me, in verse 9, This is the every 7 year cycle this happens, as well as, of course, 50th year cycle this happens. You shall sound a broken blast, which is a repetitive blast, on the shofar in the 7th month on the 10th day of the month. Well, I got between 12 and 13 month years, so essentially the opposite side of the year over here, not exact, but it's close, is when atonement happens. I'm going to abbreviate with just atone. That's when it's blasted, or everybody told, hey, Jubilee's coming up next year, or the Shemitah cycle's coming up next year, or whatever it's blasted, that's when it's declared. And so, but the years don't start and end until Aviv. But they are declared, roughly, 6 to 7 months, the opposite of Aviv, opposite of the year. So people can prepare accordingly as the cycle goes through. So I go clockwise in the cycle. So here's summer, and here's winter. This is how we do things. Yes. Ah, that's what we're talking about, the 49 and 50 year. So when you have a 49 and a 50th year together, those are two back-to-back years as far as how do you run through this cycle. Well, let's draw and see what happens. Not too complicated, it's pretty simple. Let's pretend this little cycle, which drawing I have up here, let's pretend that this Aviv one, we're going to say this is year, the starting of year number 48. All right, so it's been through, we've been through previous 47 years, right? So 48 has Aviv one, that's great. Well, 49 is going up soon. So you go through here 6 months, or 6 to 7 months later, usually 7 months later for atonement, you rattle off that, hey, the next year, when it starts again, will be the Shemitah cycle, which means the 7th year of rest. So the land's got to rest. That means the land doesn't get sown or harvested from this date Aviv onward for a full year. So basically, you have approximately 6 months that you can plant, you can prune, you can do whatever you want up until Aviv starts, and then you're done. Leave it alone. So you can plant a whole bunch of crops you want. Who cares what you plant? Plant, harvest, do whatever you want, all the way to this point. That's when the 49 year begins. Now, the land is for everybody. Free for all, so to speak. You don't get to harvest it for crops, meaning when they're referring to harvest it, they're not referring to going out there and grabbing a piece of fruit and eating it. They're referring to harvest as in a farmer making a business. They're gathering the crops to harvest them and sell them or distribute them or whatever they're going to do. That's what they're referring to, gathering your crops. That's what the term is. It's not to go out there and grab a piece of fruit and eat it. That's not considered harvesting. That's because you're eating. It's a different purpose. A different the scope of the activity is very, very different. You're doing a very small amount, your personal family, friends, neighbors, relatives. It's not for business purposes. So at this point, when you reach the 49th year begins, you're done. You gotta wait. So you can, it's springtime, things, assuming you were smart, the previous 6 months you planted crops that would, sow and grow and reseed themselves very well. So come springtime, there's plenty out there to gather and eat, which that's why you got 6 months to prepare. Hopefully you did so. So you have 6 months to prepare, do the work that has to be done. When this starts, you're done. So you can collect various things for your own personal use, but it's not for selling. All the way through atonement. Now, in this case, atonement should begin because 49th year, the 50th year is declared also. So the blast of shofar is blasted again. But either way, you're still not harvesting. So atonement through Sukkot, you're still not harvesting all the way through year 49 till 49 finishes. But now we have, in this particular case, year 50, which the same thing happens again. There is still no crop harvesting the whole cycle through until the year finishes at Aviv. So you have two consecutive years which you are not harvesting and you are not planting. They are full years, not half years, as some have argued. So they are full years which you are complete. And then you have the 50th year which you finish. When the 50th year is done at Aviv, you didn't plant anything the previous winter because it was still the 50th year. Now you can harvest whatever wild grows, because it's been growing for essentially two consecutive years on its own. Hopefully it grew well. You can harvest and eat as you wish, because now you're in the next cycle year of your Shemitah cycle you're going through. Any question about that cycle so far? Hopefully it makes sense. In this case, we have a 49-50 of two consecutive full years, which you are not planting, nor are you... They can be 13-month or 12-month years. It's hard to say which how long it's going to be. It varies from year to year. It could be 26, 25, 26 months.
I said that before. We can have a personal food, right? But we're not going to be like, I'm a wheat man. I can't do the wheat, right?
Right. This is not referring to your personal gardens.
Right.
That's not referring to, this is farmers growing and producing things for crops. Because your personal garden, do you go and sell that? No. What do you do with it? Yeah, give it away. The garden is not this. This is not a garden we're dealing with. This is not personal gardens. That is the opposite. Because personal gardens has nothing to do with the Shemitah cycle year. If you are making a dime off of it, you just switch from personal garden to business. Then you have a different story going on. Personal gardens are not classified in this grouping. They're not concerned themselves with personal gardens. You are a one person. How big is your garden? If you're lucky, quarter acre. If that, probably a lot smaller for a single person, small family. Then that's not what it's talking about. It's referring to actual businesses, farmers. This is their livelihood. This is their existence. Note, the Shemitah cycle and the Jubilee cycle grows and expands and is also brought into everyday businesses too, as well as our personal lives, later on in Deuteronomy, which we'll get to later. In this section, Leviticus, it is specifically talking about growing crops and how you grow them and when you don't grow them. That's the... This is how you're going to do it. So he points out that, well, what are you going to eat? Right? They come up in verse 20. You say, what will we eat in the seventh year? Behold, when I sow and gather crops, I will day my blessing on the sixth year. So the whole point is that year 48 in this case is also, of course, all the year sixes and everything else that went through every 7-year cycle. That 48th year from the spring all the way through as you were cropping and planting, or gathering and planting, God blessed it. It was supposed to last. In this instance, he spelled out here, this applies not to just Jubilee years. He's referring to the seventh year. It will last enough for 3 years, assuming you obey this instruction. So 3 years means it has to completely last through sixth year, which is case 48, as well as all the way through the seventh year, as well as all the way through the eighth year, and into the ninth year when the springtime comes, which you can then plant and do whatever you want, you will have run out of your 6-year crops. I don't know what you grow for during that 6 year, but hopefully it lasts a long time, doesn't require refrigeration, but who knows. So that's what they're going to grow. That's the intent. And he does that every single year, every single cycle of 7. So not only does it apply here for Jubilee, it also is going to apply for every cycle of 7. So whatever you grow in the 6th year will last through the 6th, 7th, and 8th, and the 9th year is when it runs out. Yes.
I don't understand the 48. Is that the Shemitah?
Yeah, sorry. I did a dot, dot, dot here, which you probably couldn't see.
What's the 49 stuff? What is 49? And I know if we have the Jubilee, but why is it 3 years in a row?
Well, it's not 3 years in a row. The 49, this blue circle here, that corresponds to the end of the last of the 7 years, because we have 7 year cycles, right? Every 7 years, we have a cycle repetition. So the first set of 7, I drew up here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's cycle 1, and it repeats. The next time would be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and then 14, and then 15, 16, all the way through goes the cycle. I just did a dot, anyone draw all the numbers out for you. And the last event, you go 43 year, 44th year, 45th year, 46th, 47th, and 48th year is the 6th year of that cycle, of this cycle. Right. Residue which you can plant and gather crops in. And the 49th year corresponds to the 7th as well as 14th year, the Shemitah year cycles. Correct. And then this circle over here, I'll erase this, is Jubilee, which is 50. Yeah, in a Jubilee year cycle, which the Shemitah ends, it's 2 consecutive years, which is the 49th year and the 50th year, which you are not growing crops and harvesting them and selling them and making a living off it. The land grows whatever it's going to grow. You don't till it, You don't cut it. You don't prune it. You don't weed it. You don't spray it. You don't do anything to it. Anybody can walk through. The wild animals can walk through. The poor can walk through. Anybody can walk through and gather what they want, but not for sale. They're not to gather it and sell it. They're to gather it to eat it. Make sense? You can eat it, yes, but it's not for business selling purposes. Yeah. The wording here is confusing because it says you can't gather your crops. Well, the phrase gathering crops refers to harvesting as in to sell, to make a product to sell, not gathering crops because you're hungry to eat them. That's a different, it's like I said before, it's a scope. One is for business to gather and to sell. The other is to, I'm hungry. I'm going to go eat it. Same process, same mentality. Yes.
Are we in a semitah?
Right now, we are in a jubilee year.
We're in a jubilee.
According to most, not all, most belief people, most people, how they count the cycles. This year is a jubilee year, which ends in spring. This coming spring is a jubilee year ends. Yeah. So, our jubilee year began at 2 weeks before Passover, this past Passover. That was a jubilee year cycle began. So it begins in the spring and ends in the spring. They are declared 6 months opposite, but they begin and end in spring. Yeah, we're in the 50th cycle, right? Well, according to most, not all, most scholars. Yes, Anne.
We could eat the protein, so we'd just be meat eaters for.
Oh, there's dairy. There's various wild things you can eat. There's honey. What else you can get that you can grow off a field? Yes, Deanne.
49 days from Passover. Does this have anything to do with that?
There is a duplicate parallel. Yes.
Okay.
We'll hopefully talk about that as well. Not as extensively, but also it is. You will see, it's obviously a mirror image of what the cycle is, too. It's not exactly duplicate, but it is still very similar imagery. It should. So this cycle, of course, is a process of counting. It goes through the seven cycles and through the Shemitah and the Jubilee or Yovel years. Any questions about how this cycle is supposed to work as far as how the drawing works? How the counting cycle is supposed to work? Make sense? Summer. I was drawing it just for my personal reference so you could see how I was looking at it. It's really, so it doesn't have to be on top, it's just where I put it. You can have somewhere on bottom if you want. But that's how I draw things. So I was just showing you how the cycle of a year went through my drawing. That's good. Okay. Okay, so that's how the counting works. So what do we do? Let's find out. It says here in, a couple of different spots, actually. Let's see here. Middle of the year, cycle. This is what's confusing about some of this. Well, to me, it's somewhat confusing. It says in verse 10 of chapter 25, you shall sanctify the 50th year, which means set it aside, and proclaim freedom throughout the land for all its inhabitants. It shall be the jubilee year for you. You shall return each man to his ancestral heritage, and you shall return each man to his family. Let's contrast that to a few other scriptures in the Bible regarding what you can and cannot do, what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do. Let's jump to Exodus chapter 21. Exodus 21, starting in verse 1. These are the ordinances you shall place before them. If you buy a Jewish bondsman, he should work 6 years, and the seventh year shall go free, no charge. If he shall arrive by himself, he shall leave by himself. He's the husband of a woman, his wife shall leave with him. If his master will give him a woman, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master. He shall go out by himself. But the bondsman shall say, I love a master, my wife, my children, I shall not go free. Then his master shall bring him to the court, and shall bring him to the door or the doorpost. And the master bore through his ear with the awl, and he shall serve him forever. That is different, it appears at least. It really isn't that much different, it appears different from Leviticus' instruction in 25. It also appears different from Deuteronomy as well. We're going to discuss these a little bit and compare a few of them. I'm going to erase this drawing because I hope you all figured it out by now. Okay. Good question. You know, okay, yeah. Who's gonna say, okay, yeah, I really didn't care for my wife anyway. Who needs my kids? I'm going to haul my own. Call my own. So in Exodus, we have the man, he serves for 6 years. Now this is a bond servant, which essentially is a slave, but not in the class that we think of slave. It is an indentured servant via either debt, they needed help, whatever. You bought them for whatever reason you bought them. They're not a slave like you think of menial task slaves. They are bond servant, which they are servants to you, which like David had lots of servants. So he serves for 6 years, and the seventh year, spell year correctly, year, he goes free. If he wants to. Of course, he has to leave his wife and kids behind if the master gave him his wife. That is, well, sometimes you have a reason to as a master, but we'll discuss that shortly. So in this instance, he's obviously allowed to leave in 7 years. If he chooses not to, he can stay, as it says here, forever. What does that mean? Well, he's a Jewish servant, or an Israelite servant. He's from the people of Israel. Well, Leviticus states quite clearly, he will go free in the year of Jubilee. He will go free, and his children, and his wife, they will go free in that year cycle. So, forever doesn't mean forever like we think of forever. Forever, it might be the man's life, depends how long Jubilee is. If he's like in his 50s, he's sold to you, he's not going to live to be 100, so he may not be there. But if he's not that old. So the 70 is free if he wants to by himself. Meaning, leave the wife you gave you, master, leave the kids I had with her, I didn't really want them anyway. I'm going to go on my own business, do my own thing. Or I'm going to try to buy them from you, which he can do that too. He can redeem them. He can leave, say, hey, I'm going to leave my wife, my kids with you. I'm going to make some money. I'm going to go buy them off of you and then set them free too. He can do that too, which is a legitimate way of doing things. The other option, of course, which is to stay. So the stay, that means in the seventh year free, he doesn't go free. He stays until however many years later it may be, the Jubilee happens. I spell it right. I spell it differently every time. Then he, his wife, his kids are free. Now, what if, hypothetical circumstance here, it is 2 years shy of the Jubilee year. So this is year 48. And you buy a guy. He's a Jew. He's Israelite. He's poor. He has the money. You buy him. Okay. You buy him. You give him a wife. This is your kind. And he has a baby too. So it's year 48. You buy him. He has a wife. He's at work for you for year 48. And year 49, which is the 7-year cycle, yeah, his 7 years aren't up yet. But this 7-year freedom is not 7 years from purchase. It's a fixed 7-year cycle. So he gets to go free without his wife and kids the next year. Or he say, I'm not going to go free. He gets his ear pierced by an awl, and his wife and kids go free with him the following year. Now, if I was the master, would I pay a lot of money for this particular servant? No. Not a good business model. You wouldn't. You say, okay, I'll pay a little bit, because at least get a year's worth of work out of you. Maybe a year, I can do some other non-crop-based tasks on 49 if you don't want to go free. But I'm not going to pay a lot of money for you because I'm only going to get 1 year of work out of you. You're only worth a year. That's the same instruction gives you to the crops. Do you notice that? You have to calculate how many years of crops you have left. I have this many years. Then this is how much this land is worth. It's the same thing with the people. That's why the land and the people are one and the same. We are made from dirt to dirt we return. We're supposed to be the same. You treat the land as you would a person. Treat a person as you would the land. Treat them with full respect. Do you abuse land? Do you abuse people? No. treat them both with honor and respect, because both land and people belong to one individual, and it's not you, not me. It belongs all to him. So in many, many years following Leviticus, of course, the Israelites did not give their land years of rest. They go through the exile for 70 years, every year corresponding to the Shemitah cycle years. They did not give rest. It adds all up. Does the math, how many, tells you how many times it's been. The whole point is that they were essentially enslaving their land as you would enslave a person, in this case themselves too. For all those hundreds of years, they were not observing any of the rest cycles. Okay? So this particular gentleman, if he was bought in the 48th year, he'd only be worth basically 1 year's work. And then if for some reason he had a baby with the wife you just gave him, he may want to stick around for another year. Or leave. But the drawback he'll have with leaving, let's say he says, okay, it's 40th year, I want to leave. Who's going to hire him? It's the Shemitah year. There aren't jobs to go, oh, I'm going to leave, go find another job over here. There is no other job over there. Because everybody's looking for another job or do something else, because there's no business aren't happening. So there's a good probability he might say, bad year to leave, because this is an economic recession for this year. I'll hang out for a little while longer and wait till the following year. But only the following year is a jubilee, a freedom year. And the following year was not. Let's say, for example, this man was bought in year 6 instead of year 48. The following year, of course, year 7. So he's purchased in year 6, is 1 year of work. The following year is year 7. He doesn't want us to go free because there's no jobs. But then he gets his ear pierced. What does that mean? He just dedicated himself all the years until he reaches year 50. That's a big risk. You know what? You might say, I'll go anyway. Just because I don't want to dedicate the next, 43, 42 years left to work for you, master. I want to go live my own life. And I want to buy my wife and my kids off of your hand and set free and go through this process. Now, to be fair, he may have also been paid a lot of money for him if he was bought in year 6, because there's so many years left, but maybe not. He only had technically, there's so many years for Jubilee, but only 1 year for the Shemitah. So it's hard to say what that particular slave or servant would like to do. And the master doesn't know ahead of time. Hopefully this... Yeah, exactly. It's like rest years. So rest days, rest years are the same cycle, same picture. Hopefully this makes sense to you so far. Now, it points out here a number of times. This is at least 2 or 3. As verse 14 says it, and verse 17 says it. When you make a sale of your fellow, make a purchase, do not aggrieve or aggravate one another. Let's discuss this. Yeah, don't cheat each other. Let's say, for example, we have this diagram up here. There's 6 years we're supposed to work for. And a man's poor. He said, hey, massive debt, crop failure, something happened, whatever. He's poor, he's desperate, he needs money. He wants to sell himself to somebody else who has money to work for. And it happens to be year 6. And the guy says, wait a minute. If I spend money on you now, I only get you for 1 year. I'll wait. I'll wait until 2 years now. In year 8, I'll buy you. I'll at least get you for 6 years of work. No. That's not treating fairly. The man's poor now. He needs work, he needs help now. Not 2 years from now when it's more convenient, more economically advantageous for you and your business. It's now. And that's what it means by do not aggravate. God sees, and you can say, I just don't have use for you right now. You can lie to him. But God says, hey, I am the Lord your God, meaning I see what's going on. You shall do it according to the number of years or less after Jubilee or for the Jubilee, depending on how the cycle happens to be. Increase the price or decrease the price accordingly. Each of you, verse 17, should not aggravate his fellow. You shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. God knows whether you're lying to the man. I just don't have work for you right now. In reality, you just don't want to waste your money on 1 year's worth of labor. It might take you 6 months to train the guy. Yeah, that's not worth it, right? Well, that's how it works. Oh, that was verse 17, I think. I ended in verse 17. Typically, yes. It's a full price up front. It's a big chunk of change. Yes, it is. It's a huge amount of money. Yes.
So when the husband, if it's a good time to go, when he can earn his money to buy his wife and children back, does he buy them back at the price that the master paid for them?
It depends on how the master acquired them. The master did not acquire the children, per se. He didn't buy them.
No,
it was
it's
a physical
geometry. Right?
Yeah, it's the number of years, because she is a maidservant to the master. And he is a manservant to the master. She has her own price, depending on what she does. Maybe she's some skilled laborer, or maybe she's a menial task laborer. I have no idea. But whatever her task, whatever value she is, that's what she's worth. And that's what the price is paid for. Make sense? If she is an Israelite, however, the same thing applies to her. She's allowed to go free too in that year cycle, the 7-year cycle, because she's an Israelite also. If she was not an Israelite, but she was given to you as a man, as a bond servant, for a wife, she's from some other race, some other groups, whatever, who knows, then she does not go through, she doesn't get to go free in the 7th year cycle, as every Israelite does. Does that make sense? So we can argue, well, that's racist. It's nothing to do with race. He can buy her back at any point in time. Whatever she's worth, he can buy her back. So, what was that? Sure, we have money. They have money. Yeah, the coins, they have money. They just we have money. A servant, well, the bond servant, they're allowed to make money on the side. And they're also about to leave and go start a business somewhere else. Let's say, for example, just hypothetically speaking, slave number one went to master number one. Master one happens to be a blacksmith. Makes lots of metal parts for farming equipment and horseshoes and whatever else he makes. And the blacksmith says, hey, slave number one, sure, come in, I'll work for me. I'll teach you how to be a blacksmith. Well, that's a valuable skill in the farming community. And so when the slave does, okay, my time's up, but now I have a great skill. Not necessarily, it could be 7 years later, he'd be old, or it could be 1 year later, who knows? But, yeah. If he's not necessarily old 49 years, he's a Jewish Israelite slave, he has the option of leaving in the first Daenerys Shemitah cycle happens. He'll have the skill level. He can go start his own business, make lots of money the next year or 2 years later, and buy the wife or children free. Whatever the value is, it's not my business, I don't set value to people, but that's what it would be. Okay, it makes sense? That you have the ability to earn it. And it explains in here as well, as options, in verse, where was it? Where is he? Sells himself and he finds the means to redeem himself. He's allowed to redeem himself. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere. I forgot the verse. For his redemption. If his means suffices. In verse 26, if a man will have no redeemer, but his means suffice that he acquires enough for its redemption, he should reckon the years of his sale and return the remainder to the man to whom he had sold it, and should redeem it to his ancestors. That's property. But it happens to a man as well. So if a man is sold and he acquires money for himself over time of the sale, maybe he's working on the side, who knows what he's doing, he can buy himself free according to the number of years left. Now, if he's an Israelite, he knows he has a 7th year free option. But if he had his ear bored out, he doesn't. He has to wait till the Jubilee year. But maybe in year number 46, he doesn't want to wait the extra few years. I have enough money. I'll buy myself free now. The remaining 2 or 3 years I have left, I'll pay you those 2 or 3 years, and I'm free. You can do that at any point in time as well. Make sense? So you can buy your own freedom. Your relatives can buy you free as well, for the same cycle, same purpose. If for some reason you desire, your relatives have money to pay for, they can buy you free also. Okay? Any questions so far about that? He gives ways out continuously. There's always a way out. At any point in time you want to take it, there's always a way of freedom. It's important. Remember, there's always a way to freedom. Because, who are we slaves to? It's supposed to be God. What if we sin? Who are we slaves to? Sin. Can you ever get free from sin? Yes! There's always a way out. Yes.
So since the non-Israel cannot get free,
Not even
in the 50th year. Because I remember there's another law that
there is a law.
Non-Israelite, after 10 years or something like that, they can actually go to the to the temple or to the presence, and that's okay. But before that, they can't.
There is
the Moabites or some.
That's the 10-year law is not written in the Torah. It sort of. There's a way in which a non-Israelite can get free also. And it's actually written here in chapter 25 as well. We'll discuss that. It's a trick on the word. Let's see, verse. I had it written down here on purpose, so I wouldn't forget it, and I lost my notes. Oh, there it is. Verse 36. 37. So let's see, it says, okay. Let's see here. Oh, nope, that's the wrong one. Verse 35. I didn't write down where it is. Where it says the sojourner or proselyte. The servant. Okay. Well, that would be the same classification. That's if a brother becomes impoverished. Referring to when it says the same thing applies to sojourner or a proselyte. To verse, where is it? I guess I didn't write it down, I should have. Okay. Well, here's the details. Some of the details, at least. There's a description here as far as how this outside non-Israelite person becomes a slave, and how do they get free, if ever? It says, if your slave or maidservant, verse 44, to whom you may own, from the Gentiles who surround you, from the nation you may purchase a slave or maidservant, also from the children of the residents who live with you, from them you may purchase from their family that is with you, whom they begot in your land, and they should remain yours as an ancestral heritage. So this is a person who never, ever gets free. This in the description we hear, a slave who you buy from the Gentiles, or if you buy from the residents or sojourners, families within your area. They are never free in this description, but there's a trick. To remain yours as an ancestral heritage, verse 45. You shall hold them as a heritage for your children after you to inherit as a possession. You shall work with them forever, but your brethren with the children of Israel, a man with his brother, you shall not subjugate them to hard labor. So in verse 44 through 46, it gives an example, which is confusing to us at first, until you see the obvious caveat. It says, hey, so Mr. Shmuley is Jewish. He buys Bob, who is Gentile. Well, Shmuley buys Bob. Bob's his and his children forever. So Shmuley has generations. Let's say Bob's young. We'll give him maybe he's 15. 15 years old. We'll give him, he's young guy. He's Gentile. 15 years old, he gets purchased by Shmuley. Maybe Bob's dad sold him. Who knows? Maybe Bob got in some gambling trouble and said, hey, I need to pay off my debts. I don't know. It's Bob's problem, not mine. So Shmuley buys Bob at Bob's 15. And Bob works for Shmuley and Shmuley's children. There's what's a good name for Shmuley's kids? We'll call him Shmulet. Shmulet, his daughter. So Bob becomes Shmulet's servant. Shmulet may not be born yet. There'll be a difference. All the way until Bob dies. Poor Bob. We'll give him a little tombstone. Rest in peace. Okay? Until he dies. How does Bob ever get free? Not in this instruction he doesn't. But here's the drawback. That Mr. Shmuley and Shmulet have a responsibility to teach Bob something very particular. What is everyone's responsibility? You must teach who God is. Teach about God, teach them who they are and what they're supposed to do. Once Bob, who's 15, a Gentile, wherever he got from, came from, who cares? He's 15 and he says, hey, I believe in God now. Thanks, Mr. Shmuley and your daughter Shmulet. Guess what? Now he goes through the Shemitah cycles. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And he is free on year 7. This is problematic for Mr. Shmuley if he teaches Bob how to read the Bible. It's a greater sin for him not to. So Mr. Shmuley may buy Bob it's still Bob's choice. Say, I believe in your God, or I know I want to believe in the idol of my fathers, my grandfathers, my ancestors. Bob can make the choice. But the point is, Mr. Shmuley and his daughter and every generation afterward, their job is to teach Bob about God through their life, through examples. It's instructed through the Levitical priests. Levites are supposed to do that. They're supposed to instruct their people who are beneath them. You are supposed to be the light of the world. You're supposed to spread out God's word throughout the whole world. They spread throughout everyone. You'd be the light of the world. You can't be that light unless you're an instructor. It is an extrapolation based on what God instructed everybody of Israel to do, to watch each other, make sure we're doing as best we can, following God's laws. It's also the responsibility of the king of your country to make sure all the residents are obeying the laws of God. Is Bob a resident? Absolutely. What happens then? Does he have to obey Shabbat? Yes, because his master has him obey Shabbat. Does Bob learn everything there is under the sun when it comes to God? Everything the master knows, and whatever the king dictates happens. You'll notice a few times the king actually talks about, they set up a type of school or instructions. They spread the word of God throughout their land a number of times. That is a process of instructing. Well, it instructs everyone. Now, Bob is choosing to live here in Israel for whatever reason, probably because they're good people. He is going to go through this cycle if Shmuley is a true follower of God. Yes, Jeff.
No, I mean, a key example of this in action is the book of Ruth. Because
yes.
this an example of someone, you know, from Moab who married into Israel and then, you know, later saying, look, you know, your God is my God. And your
yep.
people are my people. So basically grafting themselves into the people of Israel. And then you see, wow, she's included into
the line of Messiah. So clearly she went through this. Although I didn't write her name, she went through Bob's cycle. A little different, but same principle. Once you learn it, then the Shemitahs apply, as well as Jubilees apply, and everything else applies. Now, what if Shmuley says, I'm not going to teach Bob how to read. I'm not going to teach Bob how to do anything. That's called, you know, what the Americans say to the black slaves. There's a big deal about slaves who were taught to read frequently were killed for it, because they didn't want the slaves to learn how to read. You can read, you can then learn. You can learn, you can follow, not, they don't care about God's rules. You can follow in how to get yourself free. Anybody who reads God's laws can find the way, if you're in a godly society, will find a freedom route at any moment in time. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, because when the American slaves learned to read, then they read the Bible, then suddenly they started reading about the Exodus. And
like, wait a minute.
Things went south. Yeah, they did go south.
They
didn't go north.
Oh. Yes, it was a crime in many parts of the South to teach a black slave to read because they were afraid they could do this and get free. Not just this cycle, but just in freedom in general. Any questions so far? So there is a route for a non-Israelite to get his way free. He just has to agree to follow God's laws. Now, to be fair, the Shemitah cycle, is it written in laws of any other country? No. Is the Jubilee written in laws of any other country? No. If you're a slave of any other country, is there a freedom route? No. So if you're going to be a slave, well, there's a death route. You want to be free. If you're going to be a slave the way you can get free, not a slave of a country which you can't get free from. I mean, to be honest, you're going to choose one. You're better off, at least this is a way I can get out, versus I will, and my children and grandchildren will never get out. Yes, Jeff.
Sounds like a great immigration policy.
It is. It is a good immigration policy. So that's how, yes, Alma.
Well, just the comment about some Christians that they say, see, I don't want to read that Old Testament. Jesus put it in the cross and we don't have slaves. And they think that slaves are, you know, like the ones we had here in the States.
The mistreated slaves.
Now, that's not what it was.
That's not the instruction.
At all.
Right. In our slave rules, which they did, you were allowed to beat and hurt your slaves in our country. Well, the Bible actually gives you specific laws. When you cause injury to one of your slaves, in any permanent form, the slave is immediately set free. So, are you allowed to beat your slave up to bloody pulp? No, because guess what? They're free then. Of course, you may not want them afterward, but they're free. Because you wouldn't abuse them. If you're obeying God's laws, slavery is more along the lines of a hired servant who just lives with you in your residence 24/7. That's really more a better description. You pay their food, their clothing, their shelter, everything they need is covered. You don't necessarily pay them money, though, because we have minimum wage rules. But that at this time, they don't have such rules. So slaves, in the biblical definition of slave, is very, very different than man's definition of slave. There's a world of difference between the two of them. There's almost no relation other than the physical words of slave. The only similarity there is. Okay, let's continue on. There's more good stuff in here. Let's see here. So that addresses as far as the 6-year time limit and how the guy gets out eventually. Okay, let's go to the towns. I was brought up a few minutes ago. Well, almost an hour ago. We'll leave Bob and Shmuley on their own. Hopefully Bob will be free soon. Okay, so towns, houses. Now, every one of you can buy and sell a house, assuming you own one, have the money to buy it, in and around this country, quite happily, right? This is for sale, you can go buy it, whatever it may be. And we already discussed previously, technically speaking, you never actually own the house. The government always owns the house. Because you will pay them until you die. And then until your parents die, your children die, everybody dies, you will always be paying the government taxes. Yes.
Is that the same in other countries too? Nobody actually owns their property, or is it just here in America?
I believe it's the same in almost every country on Earth. There may be a few islands you can buy, but that's probably about it. Every country gets some type of taxes out of you. Death and taxes, only two things are constant, yeah? Yes, Jeff?
Yeah, well, that actually was the way our country was, which is why the eminent domain law is in there, because if you actually wanted to remove someone from your property, you actually had to pay them for it. You can't
right.
just seize it and just say, okay, it's your debt, sorry. No, that's
yeah.
a bit of why we had the debtor's prison sort of
it
system,
was, yeah.
because, okay, you go into jail, you still have your property, now you got to decide what you want to do with it. You want to sell your property to get yourself out of jail, but the government's still not going to take your property.
Right.
You're just sitting in jail.
Today, unfortunately, they'll take your property. They'll take it quite happily. So houses, in God's instruction, the houses, of course, sold inside. This is not Levitical houses. These are non-Levites. You're not buying and selling inside a Levite's house. House in cities. City. A city house, which is a walled city. Now, in modern day, we don't usually put walls around our cities because we're not worried about siege engines coming pounding the city down to kill everybody. We have political boundaries. Cities grow and expand. They move the city limits. So in our definition, modern day, the walled city is a political city boundary. So a city boundary. Yeah, city limits. City limits of Santa Rosa, city limits of Kentucky, or not Kentucky, of Chicago, whatever. There's city limits versus outside city limits. That's not considered part of the city limits. That's county typically, unless it's another city. It should be county rules then. So city houses, inside city limits, that's the buy, sell, as is. But 1 year, the person who sold it to you can buy it back for 1 year. Which means, it doesn't mean, but it basically means the person who bought it can't tell the buyer, or tell the other guy, sorry, I'm not going to sell it to you. No. That in the biblical law, if I go out and buy Shmuley's inside city home, maybe his summer residence, I go buy that house, within the first year, if any point in time he says, hey, I want to buy it back, I can't tell him, well, no. It's, okay, here's the price, and buys it back. After the year's up, he can come back and say, I want to buy it back, and I can tell him no. Or I can tell him yes, it's my choice. But the point is, it's not my choice until that full year is finished. Then it becomes my choice. This does not apply to outside city boundaries, which of course we consider as counties or unincorporated areas of a town or not town, of an area. A county area. For this is city houses, a 1 year rule. Outside, which is county rules or county areas or unincorporated areas, that follows the Jubilee rule. So the Jubilee rule then if it's in a county area. This is not applied to however at all in any way to Levites. Because Levites don't own land, they only own houses. And the immediately dirt surrounding that city. They don't have a choice. They can't sit there and say, well, I want to buy it back or not buy it back. It doesn't work that way. So Levites, their houses with inside their cities will always go free in the Jubilee year. Okay? So at least the Levites still get to maintain their inheritance. else they could lose it all, and they'd be homeless. They're inheritantless, I guess you call it. Let's see here, where was I? Okay, so that hopefully makes sense as far as houses are sold and how it's supposed to work. Okay. Now let's get into a more interesting topic. Verse 47. If, verse 47 of chapter 25, if the means of a sojourner who resides with you should become sufficient, and your brother becomes impoverished with him, and he is sold to an alien who resides with you, or to an idol of a sojourner's family, what does that mean? If a man's poor and he sells himself to an idol, this is an idol's family, or the idol from the family. So let's say we'll flip the names around. Shmuley is now poor. Is now poor. Okay? He sells himself to Bob's dad. We'll call him Rob. Okay. That works. So Rob was wealthy. Now Shmuley, obviously, you know, Bob's free now and whatever else. Shmuley has sold all the slaves. It's just him and his family. He sells himself to Rob. Rob worships idol number 4. So idol, because Rob is a priest of idol number 4. Didn't know it, but he was. And Shmuley now has to serve, who was purchased by Rob, and Rob says, okay, Shmuley, my slave, you will now serve idol number 4. Oh, maybe you have to gather water for it. Maybe you have to assist me in my slaughtering of an animal, or pouring out blood, or whatever I gotta do, because I'm Rob, the priest of idol number 4. Pretty awful experience, wouldn't it be? It'd be a nightmare. It'd be awful. So this is an interesting topic, because the point is that Shmuley was poor, and no man of Israel was going to buy Shmuley. Maybe he was old. Maybe he was lame. Who knows? Whatever the reason is, maybe everyone in Israel was poor at that moment in time. Who knows? But Rob, the idol guy, he had money. And so he bought Shmuley, and now Shmuley must serve idol number 4. Now, Shmuley's supposed to be Jewish. He's supposed to be Israelite. He's supposed to believe in God. This was about an idols, serves him anyway. But now, by slave, he's required to. Well, let's read about this. Let's read. So we have this scenario. This, he's impoverished. He's sold to a sojourner. After he has been sold, he shall have a redemption. One of his brothers shall redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin shall redeem him, or a relative of his family shall redeem him, or if he has his own means to be sufficient, he shall be redeemed. He shall make a reckoning with his purchaser from the year he was sold to until the year Jubilee. With the money of his purchase, money of his purchase shall be divided by the number of years. He shall regard it with him like the years of a laborer. If there are yet many years, he repays his redemption accordingly from the money of his purchase. If there are a few years left, Jubilee, he shall reckon with him according to his years. He shall repay his redemption. He shall be with him like a hired laborer by the year. He shall not subjugate him through hard labor in your sight. So Shmuley has family. He has, you know, maybe he's brother number 1, brother number 2. Maybe he has an uncle. No, 1, 2, and 3. What's the responsibility of all these men? Buy him back. What if they can't? Well, if Shmuley ever one day gets enough funds to buy himself back, his responsibility is not to go on vacation. His responsibility, first and foremost, is to buy himself free. That's his task number 1. Get free from this scenario. So the responsibility of his whole family and Shmuley is to get out of this scenario. Yes, Anne.
Now, remember that about Ruth and the brother-in-law that could have redeemed her, but he didn't want to, and he had to take the shoe and throw it at her or something.
Right.
So, in this case, could they also do the same? They just don't want to redeem their Shmuley out of his debt?
It's possible. They didn't want to. But now they've then violated a law of the commandments. Because God is the one who understands their heart. This is why they're saying no. They don't want to. That's a different problem. And let's discuss one of the most common reasons why you wouldn't want to. Let's pretend Shmuley, though he was born an Israelite, when he was an Israelite, not a slave, he used to worship idol number four. Let's pretend he was an idol worshiper to begin with. And he loved idol number four to start with. And that's why he went to Rob to buy himself, to get himself sold, so they could all worship idol number four together. Now, as brother to Shmuley, I'd say, you did it. You're on your own, man. You wanted it. You got it. Live your own life. Wrong answer. As brother, my responsibility is to say, Shmuley, I believe you are unwise. I believe idol number four is a very bad mistake. You should never be worshiping idol number four, Shmuley. And as your brother, I have the means, whether I don't want to or not, makes a difference. I am going to buy you free. It is responsibility of brother number four to not allow Shmuley to continue in this servant scenario. Now, Shmuley may get free from Rob, may become free and still continue worshiping idol number four. That's Shmuley's business. But you as his brother, me as his brother, it's my business to make sure he's not a slave to the idol. He may choose to do it, it's his own choice. But forced to do it, that's where I have to step in. Make sense? So that the responsibility has to fall into this category. Shmuley may be an awful guy. I don't know. But this is how the process, as his family, it's my responsibility to step in, to get him free. Now, I cannot force him to worship God, but I can pay Rob, his owner, his master, to free him. Okay? Make sense? Hope it makes sense. Any questions about that so far? Good. Next section. I read this already, but read this last part again. This is how Rob, by the way, is treating Shmuley. Verse 53. He shall be with him like a laborer, a hire by the year. He shall not subjugate Shmuley through hard labor in your sight. So, if I'm not even related to brother Shmuley, I'm not related to Shmuley at all. Maybe I'm related over here. I'm somebody else. I'm Shmo. Shmo. I spell Shmo. Shmo. Anyway, whatever. I'm Shmo over here. And I saw Rob smack Shmuley around. My job is to go two things. Task number one, talk to Shmuley's family. And that's task number two is talk to Shmuley's family. Task number one is to talk to Rob. Even not family. It says, in your sight. So if anyone sees an Israelite being mistreated, Rob beating Shmuley up a little bit, it's my job to say, Rob, you can't do that. That's against the law. And then go talk to Shmuley's family. Say, can you get the guy free? Address this, fix this, make this better. So that's for the category. The primary one is to go talk to Rob. So you can't beat up Shmuley like that. Okay? So within your sight, you can't see this. If Rob beats him up out of your sight, you have no clue about it. It's not your responsibility to fix it because you have no idea it happened. But if you do know, in your sight, you know, the job is go fix it. Okay? If Shmuley doesn't have any family, maybe somebody else will redeem him. Maybe you will. If you have the means, it's your choice. But that's, however the redemption happens, somebody has to get redeemed. And the applicable Jubilee year happens regardless, whether you're his family or not. That happens to him because he's an Israelite citizen. I'm almost out of time, and I have lots more to go through. So, any questions so far? All right. The last a couple of verses in chapter 26, the first three verses, or two verses there, it rattles off, there are three important things that God would make sure you remember. If you obey these three things, most of the Shemitah cycle will do well with you, as well as Jubilee. You do not make idols for yourself. You should not erect for yourselves statues or pillars. In your land, you should not emplace a flooring stone upon which to prostrate yourself. I am the Lord your God. My Sabbath you shall observe, and my sanctuary you shall revere. So, in the Shemitah cycle year and all the Jubilee years, if you do these three tasks, you'll do well. You don't allow idols in your land. So guess what? Can Shmuley ever sell himself to rob the idol maker or idol worshiper? No, because there are no idols allowed in the land. If there's also Shmuley's not allowed to worship the idol. Idol doesn't exist. He's not allowed to build any altars to the idol. That's good too. So if you obey those rules, you'll do well. Next one is Sabbath you shall observe. That means Shabbat. It also means Sabbaths. It's plural Sabbaths. It doesn't say my Sabbath you shall observe, it's my Sabbaths you shall observe. So what does that include? It includes all the holy days. You got Passover, you got unleavened bread, you got the first fruit, you have, what are they all? You got the trumpets, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and Shemitah cycles. And the Shemitah, the seventh year, is a Shabbat as well, Shabbat for the land. It also includes Jubilee cycles, because that is also a rest of the land. So Shabbats means all-inclusive, all the various rest days and years, in the case of a seven-year cycle, are all, you observe them all, you will do well. And of course, it says revere God's sanctuary, because I'm the Lord. Make sense? All right. We have more to talk about. Date? The 28th? The 28th, right? Is my clock right? Okay, it's a wind-up. Sometimes I forget to update the dates. I got more to talk about, though, and I won't take you too much time to do it. Because this is great and all this good stuff to learn about, you know, Jubilee years and Shemitah cycles and freedom, yada, yada, yada. There's more stuff to it, though. Because those are all, essentially, physical manifestations of spiritual ideas. Freeing somebody in the seven-year cycle and the wife and the kids and all of the ear-piercing, all that. They're physical concepts to understand a spiritual idea. All right? We'll discuss for the spiritual ideas. Not all of them, but a few. Excuse me. First place, let's head for... I'm going to pick and choose a few spots here because I don't have a whole lot of time to cover everything. First place to go to is John 8. John chapter 8. I'm not going to cover the entire chapter, just a few verses here just because I'm going to cover another place that where John chapter 8, the section applies. So John chapter 8, starting at verse 32, we're jumping in the middle of an event in Messiah's life, because I'm only after the scriptures at this moment in time. So this is taken slightly out of context. So John chapter 8, verse 32. You shall know the truth shall make you free. They answered, are we Abraham's descendants? We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free? Jesus answered them and said, most surely I say to you, whoever commits a sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the son makes you free, you shall be free indeed. So, what does that mean? Well, let's go back to our diagram. So, the master, in this case, which I had, Shmuley at one time was master, I'm going to rename him. He's now called Jesus. Or Yeshua. I don't really care. Probably he does, but the point is, identify the person. He's the master. You, me, Shmuley, are slaves. Now, the master gets to set you free and can buy you. And we are slaves to somebody. We're slaves to sin over here. The sin's also a master. And we're all little people hanging out here as little people who are slaves to sin. All right, a whole bunch of them. This Master Yeshua has the option of buying us, redeeming us. A little positive redemption, right? So he buys us out of this from this sin master over here. We say, yay, we're over here. Happy and thrilled. He set us free. From himself? No. Free from the master, the sin master was over us over there. That's the principle behind the same, the physical concept of what the cycle goes free in redeeming someone and setting someone free is based, or sorry, that's the basis, sorry, that's the manifestation of this basis. The idea of God buying you and setting you free from your master of sin. That's the point behind it. Okay? So, let's go to a few examples. The only book that has almost no other use, the book of Philemon. No, not Philippians. Philemon. Titus. Yeah. I say it has almost no other use because there's very little in it. Come on. I almost can't find it. This example of a slave. So Philemon, Verse 1. Paul, a prisoner of Jesus Christ, and Timothy, our brother. To Philemon, our beloved friend and fellow laborer. To the beloved Apphia and Archippus, our fellow soldier, and the church in your house. Grace to you and peace from God, our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. I thank my God, making mention of you always in my prayers. Hearing of your love and faith which you have toward the Lord Jesus and toward all the saints, that sharing of your faith may become effective by the acknowledgement of every good thing which is in you in Jesus Christ. For we have great joy and consolation in your love, because the hearts of the saints have been refreshed by you, brother. Therefore, though I might be very bold in Christ to command you in what is fitting, yet for love's sake I rather appeal to you instead, being such a one as Paul, the aged and now also a prisoner of Jesus Christ. I appeal to you for my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten while in my chains. It's not a biological son, by the way. It's a man. He's acquired him to Christ in his chains. Who was once unprofitable to you, but is now profitable to you and to me. I am sending him back to you, therefore receive him, that is my own heart, whom I wish to keep with me, that on your behalf he might minister to me in my chains for the gospel. But without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, that your good deed might not be compulsion, as it were, but rather voluntary. For perhaps he departed for a while for this purpose, that you might receive him forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both the flesh and the Lord. If then you count me as a partner, receive him as you would receive me. But if he has wronged you or owes you anything, put that on my account. I, Paul, am writing with my own hand, I will repay, not to mention to you that you owe me even your own self besides. Yes, brother, let me have joy from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in the Lord. Having confidence in your obedience, I write to you knowing that you will do even more than I say. But meanwhile, also prepare a great guest room for me, for I trust that through your prayers, that I shall be granted to you. Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Jesus Christ, greets you, as do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, Luke, and my fellow laborers. The grace of our Lord Jesus be with your spirit. Amen. What did Paul just tell Philemon? What did Paul just tell Philemon? Not Philemon to release. Philemon is a owner. He's a very, probably a prominent or wealthy individual. Of the... Slave ran away.
And I think that he's saved now, and he's serving with the apostle but
Paul.
He's asking for Omnius, or how do you say his name?
Yeah, Onesimus, yes.
But asking him to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And to treat him as he would treat him. And he's saying, I'll take care of anything he owes you.
Yes.
So just asking him to do the right thing, basically. Right?
Pretty much. See, here's the, there are certain, oh, I misspelled his name. Sorry, Philemon. It's an E. So essentially there are three individuals here. Now, Philemon happens to be an individual who is a follower of Messiah. Now, he is an individual who apparently, only by text reading alone, I'm not an expert in this, who apparently helps assist all those who believe Messiah in his area. Now, I believe, if I recall correctly, he's in the Colossian area. I'm not sure exactly, but the same people, they're living with him as they are with the Colossians. So he's in this area, he's a wealthy individual, and apparently owns at least one, if not more, slaves. Slave ownership is not necessarily against the law. As we already read the Torah, it's perfectly acceptable as long as you do it right. Onesimus was once Philemon's slave. Onesimus, apparently, somehow, at some point in time, got free. And went to, most likely, Rome, where Paul is. Go figure. He goes to Paul. Now, Onesimus probably went to Paul, just guessing, because he knew Philemon. And Philemon probably talked about Paul and thought, hey, Paul in Rome, maybe he'll help me. Onesimus, apparently at some point in time, hooks up or meets up with Paul. Onesimus, after meeting with Paul, then believes in Messiah. Paul's a good teacher. Good job. So he believes in Messiah now. All's happy, all's good, right? Onesimus is free, Paul's, well, he's still in chains, but it's all good, right? No. Onesimus did something against the Torah. You have to actually go back and make corrections for your mistakes. Paul knows that. And so what's Paul doing? Good job, Onesimus. You know you believe Messiah? Now go back to Philemon. Go back to your owner. You were a slave. Finish your slave ownership in slavery. Because if Philemon is a believer and you're a believer, guess what happens, Onesimus? You have to follow the Torah. And you get free, but you have to follow the Torah to do it. Not on your own. You'll just run away. Whatever the deal may be. Now, Onesimus, as Paul points out, maybe he did something wrong to Philemon. If he stole something, maybe he hurt you, did something, whatever it may be. I'll cover his costs. But Philemon, receive him. Not as a slave. Not as a master receives a slave. But as a master receives a brother. He believes in Messiah too now. So what are we learning from this process? This slavery masterhood process? We're learning how a master, Philemon, treats a believing slave, Onesimus. And how God treats all of them. Because guess what? All of them are slaves or prisoners of Messiah. They're all slaves. They don't see themselves that way necessarily. But they're all slaves. They were slaves to sin, now they're slaves to God. Does a fellow slave beat another slave? They shouldn't. No. The fellow slave mistreat another slave? No. You're all these slaves belong to the master, God. So that's essentially the primary function of the book of Philemon is to read about how a master and slave relationship is supposed to work when someone and all parties believe in or follow both God, the Torah, the Torah written, as well as believing what Messiah said. Hopefully that makes sense. So we go through a physical idea of a spiritual concept. What's Philemon essentially doing inside of himself? He's forgiving Onesimus. And he is receiving him as a brother, as a friend, as a fellow servant, as opposed to a master. Make sense? Onesimus could buy himself back, assuming he has the means to do so. However that's going to work, I don't know. And I don't know what year it happened in. It could be who knows, the cycles. I don't know. It doesn't make a difference as far as what year it was. He's supposed to still follow the law has to be addressed. So Onesimus does not get to run away from his master. He must return, he must address, make good whatever was robbed, stolen, mistreated, whatever. Make it correct. Fix it. Paul could buy him if he wanted to. But Paul's instruction was to go back to Philemon. Note, when a slave runs away, what do most masters do? They hire slave hunters. People whose job is to go find the slave. So Onesimus can't just wander around the city for the fun of it. There are hunters after him. So he's going to have to go back to Philemon. The hunters will say, oh, okay, I'm not going to search this guy anymore. He'll take his most wanted picture down. And now he's on his own. Go hunt for somebody else. So he has to correct that. Else Onesimus will always be on the run. And particularly in Rome, main city of Rome. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of hunters hanging around Rome looking for slaves. And a runaway slave usually only enjoys two ends. It's either a horrible beating or a really gruesome death in the Colosseums. So, choose your own. Let's see. The last place I want to end. Messiah did this in Luke chapter 4, but I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go to what he's quoting. Isaiah 61. Messiah quotes this in Luke chapter 4 in verse 16 through 21. Messiah points out that in this section, he only quotes the first couple of verses. This is fulfilled in your hearing. And the whole point is this restoration is fulfilled in your hearing. It is commonly believed or argued that this happened during a Jubilee year, which makes logical sense because it was. But that's what he read in Luke chapter 4. But he's quoting Isaiah 61. This is how we end up treating our relationship with God as our master. Okay, so we're dealing with our God, because God is now Messiah, is our master. We know who our master is. We know how we treat each other. Now, how do we respect or look at our relationship between us and him as our master? Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives, and the opening of the prisons to those who are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to console those who mourn in Zion, to give them beauty for ashes, oil of joy for mourning, the garment of praise for spirit of heaviness. They may be called trees of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he might be glorified. And they shall rebuild the old ruins. They shall raise up the former desolations. They shall repair the ruined cities. The desolations of many generations. Strangers shall stand to feed your flocks. And the sons of the foreigner shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers. But you shall be named the priests of the Lord. Men shall call you the servants of our God. You shall eat the riches of the Gentiles, and in their glory you shall boast. Instead of your shame, you shall have double honor. Instead of confusion, they shall rejoice in their portion. Therefore, their hand shall possess double. Everlasting joy shall be theirs. For I, the Lord, love justice. I hate robbery. For burnt offering, I will direct their work in truth. And I will make with them an everlasting covenant. Their descendants shall be known among the Gentiles, their offspring among the people. All who see them shall acknowledge them. They are the posterity whom the Lord has blessed. I will greatly rejoice, the Lord. My soul shall be joyful in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with the ornaments, and a bride adorns herself with jewels. As the earth and brings forth its bud, as the garden causes the things that are sown in it to spring forth, so the Lord will cause righteousness and praise to spring forth before all the nations. This chapter 61 is essentially talk about how Messiah is going to be dominating, or how he is going to be ruling over all of his servants. So, if I was a servant, I'm going to be Messiah's servant, and I have the option to go free, am I going to choose it? No. But I love my servant. I love my master. I love the wife that he gave me. I love my children that I got. I want to stick with that. So that's me having my my ear pierced by him as my master. So this process that Paul is going through, Philemon and Onesimus, it's a forever thing. It's like, okay, you're my brother until I don't like you anymore. It's a brother forever. And Messiah as our master, this is how he's supposed to treat us as our master. Not so bad. Not so bad. It's good to have a good master. Any questions or comments? Yes, Jeff.
So what you're saying then is with Messiah, we need to go all in.
All in. Yes, all in. Yes, all in. Any comments or questions about this section? The next, chapter discusses when you don't obey God's laws and see what happens to you. The master's not so good. But in this part, it's how good a master can be. And how, if God's going to treat us that way, how are we to treat each other? At least well. We don't abuse each other. We don't abuse the Shemitah. We don't abuse the Shabbat. Man is free. He's free. You give rest. You give the same things you would want from him. You give to others too. Whether they are your servants, employees, or your co-workers, or your children, or whatever. The point is, the relationship has to be the same. You want to mirror him. Be like him. He's treating you like this. Well, eventually, when it comes to rules, how should we treat each other then? Pretty well. Do it as you want them to do it to you. We'll close the prayer. Almighty God, thank you for your time, for giving us this day of rest. Father, we ask your blessing upon each one of us throughout this coming week and throughout the food that we eat. Then we'll nourish our bodies and give us strength. Father, please give us wisdom. Do what is right. Be kind to one another, to give freedom where freedom is needed and where it's warranted. Give peace to those who are seeking peace. Grant us love, Father. You have loved us for so many years. Help us to love one another and trust you. We ask your blessing, and this be a good Jubilee year. Yeshua's name.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L dot I-N-F-O, hallel.info.